Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common Magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Alaa Fox about her essay, Ramadan in Saint-Denis, which appears in the most recent issue of The Common. Alaa is a Muslim-American daughter of Chinese immigrants. She writes in English, Python, memories, and JavaScript. When not coding, she writes about life and love online at Alaa Fox. Her work has been published in Ruminate, Hunger Mountain, and Muslim Matters. She is passionate about racial equality in Oakland. Alaa, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Emily. I'm so happy to talk about my essay with you.
Would you set the scene for our conversation, just describe where you're calling from right now?
Yes, I am calling from an undisclosed Midwest location. I'm in a pretty house far out from any city with my grandmother, who I'm hanging out with for the summer. So she is in the other room. We have a dental appointment for her later today. So that's kind of like my summer big task, is to help her get new dentures because she's been waiting for a while. So it's us two, and my cat is in the room with me, but he's pretty chill at the moment.
Oh, that's lovely. That sounds like a nice summer.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to start off with a reading from your essay. Would you read the first few paragraphs for us?
Yes, let's do it. So I'll read the first two paragraphs. This is Ramadan in Saint-Denis. It is Ramadan in Saint-Denis, the venue north of Paris. It is almost 2100 hours on a June Sunday, and the sun hangs a hazy orange in the sky. The elevator in Amir's building is broken, so we climb the six stories, past the floors of muffled French Arabic and children's screams. His mother's home has one bedroom and a narrow tile-floored kitchen, like the one in my grandmother's apartment in Beijing. There is a cigarette lighter for the stove, but I am too clumsy for this, so Amir manages. I warm the meal I've brought us while Amir goes to shower. First, he heats the water in the tank above the kitchen sink, waits for the electric whine that signals hot water has begun to rise. I make us two plates of fried mushrooms and potatoes, leftovers from the dinner I cooked for the French family I work for. There is no table. I eat perched on the counter by the sink while Amir leans against the stove opposite, our knees close enough to touch. We eat slowly and smile often. We are still hungry when we finish.
Thank you for reading that. For our listeners who may not have read your essay yet, how would you describe what the piece is about?
Yeah, I'm also to hear, feel free to jump in if you have a more succinct summary, but I feel this piece is about, it really moves between three sort of triangle locations around Paris, one being the city of Paris, which is where most of my interactions with Amir take place, one being Chassy in Marne-la-Vallée, which is a small, quaint, pretty historic suburb of Paris, predominantly white, fairly affluent, where I'm working for the summer as an au pair, and the third being Saint-Denis, which is a northern commune or northern suburb of the city, also known as a banlieue, which we can get into in a bit. Which is where Amir is from and where I also end up spending a bit of time during these few months that I'm working for the French family in Chassy.
Great. Yeah. I think that's a good summary of where we are. I think there's obviously lots going on in it, but we'll definitely, we'll get into all of that. That sounds like a good summary to me. This piece is really wide-ranging. It explores a lot of personal and cultural dynamics, doesn't tie up anything too neatly. We're in these different spaces. We're, traveling through time a little bit. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about these cultural dynamics, especially around immigrant populations. I just think it would be helpful for listeners to have a little of that background as we approach talking about your piece.
Yeah, totally. So my piece touches on this, like you said, not in any comprehensive way, but as sort of an observer and as someone who is kind of on the fringe, witnessing and entering these spaces through a mirror. But for a little bit of context, a lot of people have probably recently seen video and footage from Paris. There have been a lot of riots and protests. You know, you see a lot of fires happening on the street. And this is really stemming from a recent incident of police violence after the killing of Nahel, who was 17 a few weeks ago now, in one of the Paris suburbs or the Paris banlieue. And I think I personally have seen a lot of, you know, responses and tweets of, you know, Paris is in flames, Paris is in chaos. And I can understand how one, you know, witnesses these scenes and feels that way. And in truth, people are very angry. But I feel like there is also this very, I don't even know how to describe it. When I see these things, I feel so desperate because they're not so unfamiliar. And we've seen them. I say we, I'm from America. I've grown up here, lived here my whole life, in terms of feeling like a place that is really rooted in my identity. And, you know, I say we've seen them here throughout the country as well. But in Paris specifically, it's definitely not the first time. And as I was writing my piece, I didn't talk about a lot of these incidents specifically or reference them, but there are so many of these incidents of police violence around Paris in these immigrant-dominated suburbs. And just to remember these names from, you know, the 80s, 90s, 2000s, there was a 17-year-old youth, I think 1993, his name is Macomé, who was shot point blank while in police custody in a police station, handcuffed to a radiator. And more recently, you know, in 2017, there was a really horrific incident of a 22-year-old youth, Theo, who was violently raped by French police, in such a way that he actually required major surgery just to survive. And we saw widespread protests after that as well, because the official investigation of the report said the police batons had somehow slipped into this man's body, raping him repeatedly. And, you know, you see these are just two named ones of a history of these incidents happening in the past decades, and I'm sure before in less public of a manner. And I think all of that is tangential to what I expect we'll talk more about in my essay, but something that is very much on my mind when I think about trying to place this within the time I was in Paris in 2016 and Paris today.
Yeah, it really, you know, it struck me when I was, you know, reading the news, kind of refreshing myself on what was going on in Paris now, that the teenager who was shot, it said he was of Algerian descent, which the character Amir in your essay is also from Algerian descent. And it's just, yeah, so there's sort of this feeling that there's sort of two Parises in your essay and in this experience of, you know, the Paris that immigrants experience and the Paris that maybe tourists or visitors or, you know, people who are, you know, less obviously from outside the country experience. And I really felt that when I was reading your essay. Was there a specific moment or incident that inspired you to start work on this piece? It has so many threads. I'm sort of curious how they all came together.
Yeah. So a very early version, I would say, of this piece, maybe at this point, I don't even know if it could be considered an early version of this piece, but I did write about Amir initially quite some time ago, and it was very much about Amir, about my love for him, how I knew him, and this sort of tension and I don't know if struggle is the right word, but this disappointment in myself of being unable to communicate with him because both of our language skills were so poor. I spoke almost no French. His English was a little bit better than my French, but very limited still. And so I had written a short essay, kind of just exploring this and describing this. And then I don't remember exactly what year, and I don't know if this detail made it into the final essay that was published, but at some point after Amir moved to Nice, a few years after we had known each other, he shaved his head. And it was partly because he was so, he stood out so much in Nice. And I remember the first few times I talked to him when he moved to Nice, which for folks who don't know, it's on the southern coast of France, near where they have the Cannes Film Festival every year. So pretty, much more white than, you know, Paris, which is a bit more diverse. And every time I talk to him, you know, what is Nice like? He's like, oh, racist. Like, that's his only description of the place. So anyway, he had shaved his head shortly after moving. I think just because he's so tall. He has like this, when he had long hair, it was just so, you know, beautiful and accentuated his height and just very visibly Algerian. And there was a photo that he posted after shaving his head, of him side by side with a photo of the actor Vince Castle, who is perhaps most familiar. It sounds like maybe you know who he is, Emily, but he's perhaps most famous for playing Vince, who is one of the characters in the film, the French film Lion, which I can't remember which year it came out, but a pretty classic film. About the Paris banlieue and specifically about sort of police violence within the banlieue. So when I saw that, I remember like pausing for a moment because it was interesting. He has this photo, Amir posted this photo of him with his head shaved, making this face that Vince in the film makes when Vince's has this mirror scene where he's kind of doing, I think it's like a Godfather line or, you know, some gangster movie line. He's like, you know, talking in the mirror, like talking tough to himself. And it was really interesting to me because there was this resemblance, like Amir was like making this face and there was this resemblance to Vince. And it's interesting because Vince plays the a Jewish character in this film. He's like the Jewish part of the Blanc-Bleu trio, which means black, white, Arab, which is a term and a phrase that I mention in this essay, which we can talk about a little later. But essentially, this film kind of revolves around this trio of youth. One is an immigrant from North Africa, of, you know, with black skin. One is a North African, I think, Moroccan immigrant who is Arab. And then this third character who is white. Sorry, this is a long rambling way to say that I saw this picture that Amir had posted. And I thought it was so interesting that he made this comparison of himself to Vince when, you know, just like bloodline, most closely he resembles he's half blanc, half black, half pure. His mother is of African Caribbean descent. His father is Algerian. And it reminded me of this other thing that another friend of mine, who is also from the Paris banlieue, had told me once about like race in Paris. because we talk about this a lot, and he always says, like, you know, your only people from Paris can understand it, because it's in many ways very much more like poverty, the shared poverty that is experienced within the venue, whatever, you know, skin color your background you're from, and it's so oppressive. And this started my train of thought about how does my understanding of Amir and my understanding of where he is and how I experienced those months with him between Paris and Saint-Denis and Chassy, how are those understandings influenced or informed by me approaching it as an American, as a Muslim American, with my own sort of what I might have expected to see, or what I might have interpreted based off of things that I've experienced. So that's kind of, I would say, where this essay transformed from just a story about me and Amir to trying to place that story within my history as in a daughter of immigrants, American, Muslim, and Amir's history, but as much of it as I could understand based off of how I saw him and how I understood him and what I witnessed.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you giving such a full answer for that. I think I lived in London for a couple of years, and I think it can sometimes be hard for Americans who haven't been to Europe much to understand that, like, racism there feels a little bit different than it does here. Like, in America, it is so tied into, you know, slavery and that history and you know, everything that happened since then. But in Europe, it can often feel much more about, like, xenophobia and sort of these, I don't know, complex cultural things, like preserving the home culture, and that people, regardless of where they were born, are outsiders if they don't look a certain way, or if they live in certain neighborhoods or anything like that. And it just, it's a much more complicated layer, I feel. And I enjoyed that so much about your essay, that you really, got into those complexities, which, you know, are not anything that can be easily solved in an essay.
I was going to ask you, I'm actually curious at how you guys think about this and tackle this, because I'm sure it comes across your laps a lot in essays that you read. Because one thing that I was actually nervous about in writing this is being able to speak on this with such an outsider's perspective. Like, I myself, when I had this conversation with another French friend, you know, I myself have said so many times to people that I've met when traveling, and when I talk about America, I always say, and I do feel that at people who have not grown up here or lived within this context in a prolonged way can not really understand racial dynamics in the US, no matter how much, like, time you spend later in life or how much you read and study. I think there is something very unique because of the way that America has evolved and been this quasi-pluralistic society. But I say that because I had this fear for a while of writing about the Paris Banlieue and writing about what I witnessed within France, and knowing that in some ways I will also never understand in that intimate way. And like you said, there are these similarities, but there's also these differences, and each experience is so unique and so informed by, you know, this French history of colonialism, and how that's played out in all these places where, as a result of that colonialism and, you know, economic robbery and political oppression that was experienced for so long, you know how these people who have immigrated to France and what that experience looks like, I think, is something I touch on, but at the same time, and feel that I am not the one to be able to answer those questions. And I'm curious about how you think of that as an editor of a magazine, of a journal that publishes a lot of work that is directly rooted. You know, you guys do a lot of such wonderful translations that allow us to see firsthand experiences that we wouldn't otherwise see, but also essays like mine, which are really in the end kind of observers coming in, sharing their experience of somewhere else. And I'm curious, yeah, how you've thought about that in the past.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I do feel that maybe one of the good starting points is, like you said, that we do publish a lot of stuff that is, you know, either in translation or written by people who are absolutely from those places. And if that's your starting point, then I think you can also incorporate observer points of view or outsider points of view without, you know, having to worry about misrepresentation or, you know, speaking for someone else or something like that. So I think that that gives us a little more leeway. It is something that we do receive a lot of submissions of sort of things that feel like travel writing or that are sort of American abroad or a white person in a non-Western culture. And a lot of those can be very exoticizing. And you know, often the narrative there is the transformation of the person telling the story, like how the culture changed them. And I feel we generally don't accept those unless there are, like in your essay, lots of other threads going on. And it's not so much this like personal growth journey, but more, yeah, observation and connecting dots, but not tying it up very neatly, which I feel like some travelogues can kind of try to, yeah, put things on a very neat point, and it doesn't feel very authentic to anyone's experience of either traveling or writing or being transformed by your travels. So I think, I think that that's why it works in your essay. I also think, you know, if you had visited Paris for a few weeks or a few days, you know, this would be a different essay, but you did live there and sort of really experience, you know, I mean, you lived with a French family, so you got to see like, what words do they use to describe things or how do they feel about, you know, certain dynamics within the city. And so there's these different viewpoints, even within the essays, obviously from your viewpoint, but we see the viewpoints of the people who are from the immigrant community, the people who are, you know, the typical white Parisians, you know, from money, that kind of thing. So I think it's not one note at all. So that helps a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, we haven't even talked about the Jesse Tribune yet. Almost forgot.
Yeah, I really
your second.
I enjoyed the part of the essay set in Jesse, as you say, is where you were an au pair for a very well-to-do French family. And I'm working on a book that is sort of tangentially related to like tutoring very rich kids. And so I really enjoyed that part as, you know, how you can just select these very specific details that give a sense of, you know, how different their lives are, you know, not only from our own, but also from, you know, Amir's, for example, or people in the banlieue. And this great detail that they live on the street, or in the house, actually, of the man who wrote Babar.
Yep. Yep, yep, the very house, yeah.
I grew up, I had an aunt who loved to go to France, and she would bring back the, am I saying it right, Babar?
My French is also superb, but I think, yeah, Babar, the elephant.
Yeah, and so he's an elephant who what goes to Africa, but he travels and brings back Western culture to the elephant?
Yes, that's right. So I actually wasn't at all familiar with the stories of Babar the elephant until after I left Chessy and actually started doing some research for this piece. So several years later, Eloise was actually quite offended when she first mentioned it was the house of the writer, and I had no idea. And later I realized, oh, it's actually, that is quite significant. But I guess for other folks who aren't familiar with Babar, it's a very famous classic French children's series and character. I'd say Not being from French myself, but maybe as beloved as, you know, some of our classic Disney characters that we're used to. So, you know, just classic French children's books. And the family that I was working for during my stay in France, working for, I use that term lightly because I actually wasn't actually getting paid, but I was an au pair for this family and I lived with them while I was there. And I lived in the house of the author of these books. But basically, like, you know, like you said, Emily, the story, the basic premise is about this elephant in the jungle, where to assume somewhere in Africa, and he ends up going to some Western city for some time, you know, sees Western society, lives with this a woman, I think, who kind of teaches him about, you know, Western customs, and he goes back to Africa now with all his new clothes and his new ideas, and he starts like educating the elephants and spreading civilization. And that's really the core of the story. So there's a lot of stories that sort of look at this and look at, you know, how the elephants become the leaders of the jungle, because that now they have all of this education and knowledge. And yeah, even explaining it, I'm like, well, this is obviously like so racist.
And it's really just colonialist. Yeah,
it's colonialism. And I think, you know, in the most forgiving light, maybe it could be seen as a commentary about colonialism, which, you know, maybe that's up for people to debate. But yeah, I found that really... not funny is the word, but, you know, I found that that was really something to learn that later, because I didn't know anything about Babar at the time and I didn't look it up while I was there, but to learn that later and then reflect on the conversations that I had in that house where these stories were written with the Lambert family and the children, it was just like, wow, it really comes full circle in terms of yeah. Some of the parallels.
Yeah, when I was reading, it just felt like sort of, you know, one more turn of the screw, like, oh, here's another little angle. So I'm a big romantic. So the parts of your essay that really sang for me were the scenes with Amir, which are so vivid and beautiful. I love the description of the scene when they meet. It's an underground breakdance battle. And you know, the speaker is so drawn into how in love Amir is with the dancing and the movement and his friends who he's supporting there. It's just so vivid. But I think my favorite part was this really small moment where the speaker asks the teenage girl that she's taking care of as an au pair to translate a voicemail from Amir, but the girl can't because he speaks a sort of dialect that's specific to his immigrant neighborhood. I was just wondering if you would talk a little bit more about that moment, that like additional layer of complexity.
Yeah, it was a really interesting moment for me because, like I mentioned throughout this essay, Amir and I cannot really talk to each other. And we have these sort of pseudo conversations through Google Translate, kind of, you know, throughout our essay where we're like passing a phone back, or like I remember sometimes... we actually didn't do that very much, which in retrospect, I'm wondering why we didn't, but I guess we just enjoyed struggling more of like trying to kind of piece things together. Or sometimes really Amir would even like stop and ask somebody walking past of like a translation. And that was actually very, very funny to me, because we would just be talking and Amir would stop someone and, you know, speak in French and asking, you know, how to say something in English. And it was so funny because he assumed that everyone else was going to speak English very well, which is quite funny and often true. But anyways, I quite enjoyed that. And there's this one moment where it wasn't something that Amir had sent me, but I was watching, this is like 2016, we were using Snapchat a lot. Everyone was on Snapchat and he had this Snapchat story and him and his friend, and he was saying something, they were laughing. And I was like, oh, I want to know. This is like such a warm moment. And that, like you said, that was one of the things I loved most about Amir. It just felt like he was surrounded by love and he had these very close friendships, and I enjoyed being able to be close to that, and I wanted to know what he was saying. So I asked Lisette, one of the kids that I was watching that summer, and she just could not translate it. And it was interesting, and it was interesting to me too, because she wasn't very disturbed by the fact that she couldn't translate this, you know, 10-second little video of Amir. And I was just really not disturbed, but stood out to me this moment that she could not do it. And not only could she not do it, but she was not bothered by her. It didn't seem to linger with her. She said, you know, I'm not sure. It's just a lot of slang. That's what she said. And I don't think it's that, you know, there's a whole nother dialect going on, but I think it's just, there's a lot of slang. And I mention it, I believe, in this piece. There's a specific type of French slang called verlan, which they just swap like the syllables of words. I don't know a lot, but the ones that I know, it's like instead of metro, or like when you're talking about the subway, instead of saying the metro, they say tromé, which is like just the metro, the syllables are reversed. So stuff like that. And there's a whole history of how this language came to be that's super interesting, and happy to go into if we have time. But anyway, you know, Lisette, she listened to it a few times. She said, yeah, it's hard to tell. They're using a lot of slang. And then, you know, didn't really dig further and didn't interrogate her own inability to understand further. And that, I felt, was so interesting, because I was very bothered this whole time that, you know, I can't speak French, and what this means about my ability to understand the people around me, and Amir specifically. And Amir, Lisette is French and she is Parisian, and she's just kind of not really bothered by not being able to understand a conversation that is happening in her own language. And one of the interesting things that I think about now, I was very briefly in France not too long ago, and there are a lot of youth. I was at this like tech thing, and there was some French like undergrads there, white, and they all use like inshallah. Like I was saying, they were like, to each other, they're like, oh yeah, da, 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 inshallah, inshallah, which is an Arabic word that means like God willing. Like we say it all the time. you know, just, oh, I'll see you tomorrow, inshallah. Like maybe, God willing, I'll see you tomorrow. And it's so part of French vocabulary now. It's just so ingrained in French vocabulary, and there's other words too that I'm sure, and it's like the cool thing, you know. It's like hip hop in the States, like started with the Black community, and now everything that's, you know, makes its way into popular culture, it becomes cool. And at one point it was ridiculed and villainized or whatever. So that's kind of how that moment, I remember that moment.
Yeah. It was intriguing to me because, there's another moment in the essay. I think actually it's when you talk about Amir cutting off his hair and he feels sort of farther away from you. Like there's this like disconnect between you because he looks maybe different than the way you remembered him, or different than, you know, his hair being sort of a crucial way in how you identified him. And this moment with the language breaks down between them, you know, obviously that's something that happens throughout the whole essay, but it was interesting to me because I wondered if it sort of increased that distance, like made it feel like more of an insurmountable distance, or in a way, does it sort of bring these two characters closer together because neither of them can really make themselves understood, you know, in this foreign country? Like, is that something in common, you know?
Yeah, it's a good question. One thing that I wanted to be really careful about, and I'm not sure, I'm still nervous about, honestly, with the piece, is I don't want to romanticize poverty. That was never my intention and something I really don't want to do. I think there's maybe ways that you can look at what I've written, or ways that I talk about my own experiences independent of what I've captured here that I worry come off as romantic, like some of the ways that I talk about my own friends growing up, or in some of the writing here, I worry that it creates this kind of like romanticization of struggle, which is not what I want to do. But what I ended up adding into this piece in later revisions is these moments of where I felt very warmly about Amir because I felt like I had shared experiences or could understand what I saw in his experiences. And so one of those, you know, that I talk about and is most obvious is this shared religion. And neither of us at the time, I am more so now, I think, but neither of us at the time were very religious, I guess you could say, like in a super observant way. But we still, especially after leaving each other, were very conscientious of this being a shared link between us. I mentioned at the end of the piece that, you know, I was writing this piece during Ramadan years later, and I would get these messages from Amir, like, good morning, or like, hello, salam. And it was always like 5 a.m. in Paris that you would message this, and it just felt like he wants me to know, like, oh, I'm fasting. Like, I know, like, we're, this is, you know, we have this between us, this is still something we share. And with the hair, I think part of it is, yes, I remember him in this way. And I just, you know, part of this piece is I just thought he was so beautiful, this boy. And it's my memories of this sort of like youthful romance are so warm. And when he shaved his head, I did feel like I lost something. Like, oh, he's changing, I'm changing. Yeah, we're aging, we're changing. And it felt like a loss in a way, because also to me, knowing why he did that, why he shaved his head, and the implications of that in terms of like a distancing from something of himself to belong in another context is something that I felt very deeply. And I actually never thought about the flip side of it being he is now struggling to be accepted or belong in this other context that is new for him. And now that you bring that up, it makes me feel like, wow, what a lack of empathy that I have, because yeah, of course I've experienced that. And I think I actually experienced that in a lot of ways much earlier, because I went to a predominantly white high school and a predominantly affluent high school, and that shaped hugely, you know, how I sort of later have come to defend not adapting myself in those types of spaces later in life. And yeah, I guess I could have seen that experience from that light
the way you did, in a more empathetic way.
But that's not how I did at the time. I felt it as a removal and not a rejection, but, you know, a departure.
That's really interesting. I feel like that's a great segue to one of the last questions I wanted to ask you. When we were preparing for this podcast, you mentioned that you had been nervous to have this essay published and shared within your community, you know, nervous about how it might be received. What was it that made you nervous about that?
Yeah, I think there's a few elements to that. One is, the main one is something that has made me very nervous and unsettled in recent years is what I perceive as a, like, surge, maybe it's the best word, a wave of kind of this rise of misogynistic, very conservative views among young Muslim men. And I don't think that this sort of wave is specific to young Muslim men. I think it is happening or has happened just more broadly across men in general. You know, yeah, Tolentino had that essay, Rise of the Incels, a few years ago in The New Yorker. And if you read that and other pieces that kind of look at these interesting dynamics that are happening of men, I see it too in a lot of East Asian countries where there's a heightened gap between men who want to get married and women who want to get married. There's a lot of this feeling of like hatred toward women that arises. And but more specifically to my community, I've seen it recently in recent years, and it's honestly very frightening to me. It's very, to me, un-Islamic. It's very scary the way that I feel and perceive that a lot of young Muslim men are taking and mistaking, you know, teachings from our book, from our prophet, peace be upon him, and using them in ways to kind of, I think, try to regain some semblance of power, that, you know, perceived loss of power or whatever it may be. But anyway, one of my concerns in sharing this essay is just, you know, there is still kind of this skepticism around women expressing any sort of type of desire or, you know, romance or anything on the subject. And so I think that on a basic level is something that I was nervous about, and something that I was really, really grateful to see so much support after I shared this piece. I actually had a lot of friends, both men and women, within the Muslim community, message me and share words of support about reading this piece. And that made me very happy, because I was quite honestly nervous about it, and, you know, didn't want people to pass judgment or, you know, anything else. And I didn't see that. It may have been happening in ways that weren't visible to me, which is great. I'm glad I didn't see any. So I was really happy about that when I shared it. And it actually reaffirmed me in sharing it. And one of the reasons I went ahead with, you know, writing this essay in the first place is I had shared an early draft in a writing group that I have, which is all Muslim women, and the response was so strong. It made me feel like, oh, there are a lot of other women who have stories of love and lost love, and, you know, don't feel comfortable talking about it. And we don't talk about it often publicly within our communities. And there, you know, is something that maybe we're losing with that. So that felt quite nice to have that response. That was the main concern that I had. I think tangentially, there is, you know, this separate concern that I touched on a little bit, which is like my experience of Islam is different and my understanding is different than what Amir is. In some ways, I think I caveat that because I think that's actually one of the things that we share most strongly and one of the things that requires least translation. But I think more from the standpoint of my essay, speaking to so many issues that face the Muslim communities in France, I didn't want to position myself as somebody who could, you know, really be the voice of those experiences. But I think we've already kind of talked through that a bit.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, there's so much complexity, but yeah, I'm glad that it was well received. Yeah. So one last question. What are you working on now? What's next from you?
Yes. to the last point that I shared with you, actually, regarding kind of having more of these stories or not having enough, one thing that I've been thinking about and talking about with a couple friends of mine is how we can put together a place to center and highlight and champion true stories by Muslim women of color. And that's a project that I'm really, really interested in and want to continue working on. So myself, a couple friends who have explored storytelling and other formats and podcasting, we really want to start thinking about how can we make accessible, discoverable, and support more writing from Muslim women around the world. And that is a very early stage project, but something that I feel like I would love to see. I love to be able to go. I remember there was a New York Times piece a while ago, a modern love piece, written by a Muslim woman, and it just got so much negative backlash amongst Muslims. And it made me really sad because I could see why a lot of Muslim women were attacking the writer for what they just for various things about the piece. But it also made me sad because, you know, it is a piece of woman by a Muslim writer, and I felt like I wanted to support her even if I didn't share the experience that she wrote about. But my biggest takeaway from that is like we should be able to have writing that is bad or that we hate. You know what I mean? Like like everyone else, not everyone, but you know, there's so much writing out there by white authors or even Black authors where you can just be like, yeah, this one's not for me. Like every piece is not going to be for you and every piece is not going to speak to you, but we should be able to have, I want to see us have so much writing out there that you can just be like, yeah, this one really isn't for me. And that's perfectly okay. And I think, you know, to start being able to see that and have more of those where there is just so much writing out there that can speak to experiences that I've shared or experiences that I know nothing about, but that come from people who look like me or share the same beliefs as me. I think I really want to see more of that. And yeah, that's one of the big projects that I'm working on. And outside of that, I have very, very recently, AKA within the past few weeks, started taking a stab at fiction, which I never thought I would do. And is so different from me, from what I've been doing. But hopefully you'll see more from me on that front. I'm having fun with it right now. And
One thing that I've always just been so nervous about and maybe came through in this piece is like, I don't really write dialogue.
It's hard.
it's so hard. And I'm so nervous. Like, I just, you know, I've been writing for about 2 years now. And ever since I started sharing work, everyone's like, you just add some dialogue. And I'm like, but I don't know what they said. I can't remember like what they said. And it just feels like you're making something up if you write dialogue, which I know, you know, a lot of people are able to do in ways that is very true. But for me, it always felt like a falsity because I didn't remember what was said. I was kind of just, you know, loosely recreating what was said. But now that I started experimenting with fiction, I'm like having so much fun writing dialogue. And yeah, we'll see where that goes.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, I can really commiserate. The first short story I ever wrote was about these two sisters who were like putting off having a conversation. And it was entirely because I was putting off writing the dialogue.
That's amazing.
Basically wrote a whole story about avoiding dialogue.
I love it.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to read some of your fiction. Everything sounds great. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been really great talking with you.
Yeah, you too. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to continue seeing the work that comes from the Common. It's been such a joy to work with you guys. And I love, you know, some of the stuff that I described, like you continue to offer a place with so much of this work. So thank you for all that you do.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. Yeah, your piece is just a perfect example of the kind of piece that is such a good fit for the Common because it's about place, but it's about much, much more. But, you know, the place is sort of the entry point. Yeah. Listeners, you can read this essay and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.